ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
It's found thousands of miles from here, giant kelp, an incredibly fast-growing seaweed in the Pacific Ocean. Scientists have learned that if the kelp is farmed in the ocean, it could be a huge source for biofuel. But kelp needs a lot of nutrients and just the right water temperature to thrive. That's where a UWM scientist comes into the picture. Felipe Alberto, a biologist in UWM's College of Letters and Science, has received millions of dollars in federal funding to help unlock the secret of how this amazing plant can be engineered to become an important source for energy. Alberto is our guest on today's program, and we welcome you, Felipe. Thanks for being with us. And first of all, for our listeners, let's give them a picture of just what kelp looks like in case they've never seen it.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me today. So kelps are brown algae. They're normally large brown algae, and they like cold waters around the planet, really. And because they grow to large size, they provide a lot of ecosystem services. They create, first, they store an important amount of carbon, which is really important. So they produce photosynthesis like plants. So they store this carbon from the atmosphere. They provide shelter for many other organisms. They're a magnificent organism, like a very large organism that grows really fast. So divers really enjoy them. If you ever been in the US, I guess the most dramatic kelp would be the giant kelp. If you ever been to California on a calm day and you look over the ocean, you'll see these patches of brown seaweed. And that's your giant kelp right there. There's not a lot of organisms that marine organisms that are fixed to the rocky substrate and actually reach the surface where you can observe them. So they're quite interesting in that regard.
You know, when I began doing some research for today's program, I was amazed to hear how quickly kelp grows. And it reminded me of the Jack and the Beanstalk story, where you've got a bean going in the ground and it suddenly shoots off towards the stars. It doesn't grow quite that fast, but give us a sense of just how dynamic the growth of this plant is.
Yeah, you can, for giant kelp, you can have up to 70 centimeters a day in the peak growth season of each front. So the individual, the organism itself, can have multiple of a giant of giant kelp, Macrocystis pyrifera, can have multiple fronds, but that's how fast you can see one of those fronds grow a day if you tag one and you follow it up. And then that particular individual might live up to 7 years, but the fronds itself, they won't live, they will live months, so they will live less than 1 year. So you have all this production of carbon that is just being, produced and, given back to the ecosystem, which is kind of helps on that productivity that I was just talking about. Another kelp that we also study, the bull kelp, also found in the Pacific coast of North America, all the way to Alaska, also grows quite fast, but it does all that growth in 1 year. So there's a single frond, and so you will have one every, you'll have, one individual can only have one frond and will grow dramatically all the way to the surface again. And then, that's it. That's a 1 year cohort.
And as you mentioned before, this is really a critical food source and an environment for aquatic life, correct?
Yes. Many organisms feed on it. A lot of others breathe on it, use it as protection from their predators. Some organisms that people might know, or some species that people might know, the red abalone in California feeds on kelp and is affected if kelp forests aren't present. Urchins, there's also commercial harvest of urchins for folks that like urchins. They have a fine balance between their food, a kelp, and their own impacts in kelp as their prey. And then the imbalance is when you have kelp disappearing, or you have what's called an urchin barren that eats all the all the kelp to a point where now the urchins are starving. So we have had quite a few events of that happening in California recently.
Yeah, so ecosystem is really, really critical that it be preserved. I'm sure at this point in the program, some of our listeners are saying, well, that's interesting, but why is a guy in Wisconsin doing research on kelp? Because I don't believe we have any kelp in Lake Michigan, do we?
We don't, unfortunately. Yeah, so I was working with kelp and other photosynthetic or macrophyte organisms like seagrasses before moving to Wisconsin. And I moved here for family reasons. You know, my wife was here. And, you know, I find a good environment. I during this time, I figured out that I could, you know, continue to work and collaborating with my former colleagues in the coast and, you know, acquire new ones as normal in research. And yeah, so you never know where the future lies. But so far, you know, UWM is giving me an amazing environment to work like this.
So let's talk about your research, because as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the federal government has provided millions of dollars to research kelp, not just because it's an amazing plant, but because there's great potential here for kelp becoming a source for energy. Let's talk about how and why that would happen.
Well, before this program that funded me started, a lot of breakthroughs in science and biotechnology had allowed for much more efficient fermentation of biofuels out of brown algae. So this program actually didn't went into optimizing, not that, you know, like everything in science, not that that's finished, but the breakthrough was so big that really the challenge now would be how do we harvest or create an aquaculture of kelp that is up to scale, that can deliver biofuel. The problem is really a problem of scale. How do we, you know, extract kelp in enough quantity for this to be economically viable? So the Department of Energy, through this agency called the RPE, which is an agency that funds really, you know, novel projects that are too risky for really, for, you know, companies to really fund. They came up with this program where, as you know, different categories of funding, and they're all trying to tackle this problem. How do you create large areas of kelp aquaculture so that you don't run into this problem of economy of scale? And, you know, across all these categories, most of them use a lot of engineering. Kelp is a coastal species because most of the nutrients in the ocean are in near the coast, either near the coast or in very deep waters where the light doesn't reach and kelp can't grow. And, you know, the coast is, everyone wants to be in the coast. So we can't just program to have these future aquacultures near the coast. So the big challenge is, how do we take this effort offshore? The United States, most of our listeners probably don't know, as the largest economically exclusive zone in the world. So the potential is gigantic. It's an area that is the same size as 50 states in the US. So there's a lot of potential there. Of course, a lot of people need that space to, you know, but, you know, there's a lot of potential there. But the big challenge is, perhaps the biggest one, is how do you get to kelp grow in an open ocean where at the surface where the light is, there's no nutrients for kelp to grow. All that growth that we've been talking about requires a lot of nutrients. So a lot of, you know, these categories are mostly engineers. How do you solve that problem? And there's all sorts of interesting solutions. And there's also a category which is genetics. You know, genetic. We've used genetics for, you know, decades in terms of improving land crops. And of course, kelp is no exception. You know, we can do the same. And that's where I got into. My background is really on population genetics of marine organisms, algae. I've worked with other kelps. I had background work done with this particular species. So our goal here is to use modern day genomics to advance this culture, to select lines that grow faster, that perhaps require less nutrients, thus being easily to grow offshore, perhaps that are more temperature tolerant, because, you know, global warming is a thing and impacts kelp because it's a cold water species. So that's where I get in. You know, we're trying to really bring modern genomics into kelp and to run what's called a genomic selection program so that we can have, we could in the future, provide lines of interest to future breeders for their aquacultures.
So is your focus of the research on existing kelp and looking at which genetic strains work better? Are you talking about modifying the genome of kelp and actually going in and doing some of that bioengineering to help solve the problem that you just described?
Yeah, so no, we're not really doing any modification of genome. It's really understanding, screening what exists in nature. For instance, our background work told us that in what's called the Southern California Bight, really the southernmost part of California, you know, LA, Santa Barbara, Channel Islands, all that area, we knew that most of the genetic diversity of this species of giant kelp exists around the world in that area. So it's really screening that, understanding what is there, understanding how that diversity relates to, say, faster growth. And then just creating, once you know that, and once you have a very large batch of individuals genotyped, once we know their genome, we can create a program where we breed them. We decide, you know, who breeds with whom. So we're not really manipulating. We're just saying, we're pretty much doing what man has been doing for thousands of years with crops, just, you know, what farmers have been doing for thousands of years. But now we're guided by model genomics, so we can do it much, much faster. We can see gains much, much faster. That's the promise of really getting into the genome and understanding it and seeing how it associates with traits of interest, in this case, growth, temperature tolerance.
So if you're successful in finding ways to see or develop a strain of kelp that is going to really be as productive and in as efficient way as possible, how do you take that great kelp plant that you've developed and see that it is then turned into biofuel? Is there a whole nother industry that has to support that effort? Or is that a pretty simple matter of converting the energy that's growing in some cases 2 feet a day on a single plant?
No, absolutely. That's a great question, because there's a lot of ducks that need to be on a row, right? So a lot of the extracting industry needs to be, you know, prepared and ready for this. And all these efforts have been done separately in different parts. There was, you know, maybe 15 years ago, there was a big investments out of the Department of Energy and with folks from California. And that then branched out into Chile, where there's a lot of the same species and there's a lot of actually aquaculture of this kelp. And they end up failing because of this economy of scale that I was telling you about. So doing the jump all the way to biofuels, which is kind of like the big right energy goal of the Department of Energy, will take a while. And so probably this research will have to survive in the meanwhile by figuring out other uses for the kelp and for the products of aquaculture that are not biofuel. So biofuel will have to become more of a long-term goal so that there's continuing funding between now and that period, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of other uses for kelp that where possibilities might be found, like bioactive products for agriculture, you know, extracts of kelp that make, you know, crops grow better, faster. So there's things that we're trying to, you know, work with others to explore. For us, this is also, you know, the case of there's a lot of implications of this research, as you can imagine, that are just great for us as kind of fundamentally an academic institution, like applying this to other species that might where say a profit might be easy to found, therefore funding might be easier to found, to conservation, right? So the techniques we're using that allow us to understand the DNA, of this, all these different lines, and the way that allows us to actually have this kelp here in Milwaukee, right? So my lab has one part of the life cycle of the kelp is actually, you know, replicated here in Milwaukee. So that also allows us to use it for conservation, just like a botanical garden uses seeds on seed banks to store, you know, seed for threatened species, for threatened land plant species, say, for example. So we can do that for kelp. And we have other projects that are really have a conservation biology emphasis where we can use the same techniques that we are optimizing from the Department of Energy project.
Yeah, just amazing. We're going to come back and talk about seed banks in just a moment. But first, I want to remind listeners that they're tuned in to WUWM and you're listening to UWM Today, a program where we take a close look at some of the great research that's being done at the university by scientists who come to our campus from all over the world. Our guest today is Felipe Alberto. He's an associate professor of biological sciences in UWM's College of Letters and Science. And he's working on a project that has actually brought in millions of dollars in federal funding, trying to find ways to see if we could farm in the ocean kelp or giant seaweed that might produce huge benefits for society. I should have asked you this question earlier, Felipe, but let me pose it to you now. Can people eat kelp? Is it somewhere on our menu in the future?
Yeah, I mean, giant kelp, we've tried. Giant kelp is a challenge, but a lot of other kelps. The other kelp that the lab here works is bull kelp, and for sure people, you know, use it in some places for pickle and for direct food. But other kelps, a lot of the laminarias in Asia, they're huge. It's a huge business, the amount of, you know, aquaculture of kelp, and people, you know, use it in soups and all sorts of applications in Asia. And a lot of you know, Americans do it as well. A lot of production in the East Coast, what's called a sugar kelp. So the name already tells you that it's probably more palatable than giant kelp. We've tried giant kelp, but we can't, you know, it's not really the best for food application. But yes, the short answer, yes, there's a lot of direct consumption by humans and that might change here. We're going to pretty fast run into food supply issues, humanity, unfortunately. So we have to turn ourselves a little bit more to the ocean. There's a big imbalance between what we eat from the ocean and what we eat from land. And there's a lot of competition for land for all sorts of reasons. So we'll have to turn ourselves a little bit more to the ocean.
Is it pretty common in the grocery aisles here? I haven't seen it on the shelves.
No, not here. But, you know, on the West Coast, yes. And on the East Coast, you'll see it way more often than he hasn't reached the Midwest. It's a good challenge.
So maybe the closest we've come is kale, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, exactly. Bull kelp, they call it the kale of the ocean or kale of the sea. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't such a dumb question after.
No, that was a great question.
I'll put it on the shopping list and see what my wife has to say next time she picks it up. Let's talk about the impact that climate change might be having on these wonderful plans and dreams of growing kelp and farming it on a really broad scale. I mentioned at the start of the program that temperature is an issue. Have you seen any signs that climate change has negatively impacted the kelp crops that you have been studying?
Yes, so crops, I guess we'll call it populations, right? So natural occurring kelp, there's a lot of evidence. So in giant kelp in particular, we haven't seen a big effect, but across the world, I guess one of the most important examples is in Western Australia, where thousands of miles of coast, the whole ecosystem, marine ecosystem, changed from a kelp forest into more of a turf algae ecosystem, so something more tropical. And that, of course, in association with sea surface temperature warming. In the US, we had this event starting in 2014, all the way to 17, really. That people call the blob, of which was a sea surface temperature anomaly, so a positive anomaly. If you compare the sea surface temperature with what's, you know, the average through decades, you know, temperatures were really high across, you know, the winter, the summer, spring, all this time and across 3 years. They call it the blob because on the radar you would see all this blob coming from Alaska all the way. It was just a gigantic area in the ocean that had this positive temperature anomaly. And for bulk kelp in places, you know, like Northern California, so Sonoma County and places, you know, around that area, bulk kelp pretty much disappeared together with, you know, it was all like an ecological, you know, negative vortex where you got a sea star wasting disease, sea star, you know, affects other organisms, the urchin kelp disappeared, urchin exploded, kelp disappeared, the abalone which is a big important harvest in the area, dropped immensely. So that's like in the US, that's probably the most direct impact we've seen from the blob. Somehow, giant kelp did that poorly, and it's actually a species that is able to survive in warmer water. So giant kelp will, in the northern hemisphere and in our waters, will get all the way across the border, all the way into Baja California, for example, as bull kelp will end pretty much north from Santa Barbara. So north, what's, if you know your coast in California, what is the Big Sur area around Cambria, around that area, there's the limit. So you see one species is likes a little bit more cold water than the other one. And the one that likes cold water is the one that so far we're seeing biggest impacts in the US. But across the world, there's many, many examples. I gave you perhaps the biggest one in the US, and the biggest one in the world would be the Australian one.
Got it. We talked a moment ago about seed banks. I understand that you've also received a grant and funding from the, I believe it's California, and from the federal government to see whether or not there's a way to store the genetic code for kelp that we would want to be around a long, long time in the event there is climate change.
Yes. So what allows us to do the research we first talked in terms of, you know, selecting lines is really the life cycle of this kelp. So we have, one stage of the life. To give you an example, kind of using humans that everyone knows, right? So humans have their own gametes, sperm and ovules. So those two parts in our life cycle, they're so small and they only carry one part of our genome, right? So that's why we say we have half of our genomic inheritance is from our mom and from our dad, right? So from the egg and from the sperm. So part of the kelp life cycle, we have this stage that is called the gametophyte, which is the same as imagine having a gamete, say a sperm, but now you are able to clone that gamete. This just happens naturally, right? We don't have really to do much to induce it. So this means that we can have one particular copy or half the copy of an adult, say of an adult human, and now we could just copy, have the same exact genetic copy millions of times, an unlimited amount of time. So this opens a lot of possibilities for research, because if there's any value to that particular copy, we can have it really in an unlimited way and cross it with a female, right? Half of the genome from the female side, again, that has some advantages, and again, replicate that cross, so produce the same full individual, full macroalgae, as many times as we want, right? So the other cool thing we can do about it is that sperm, to get the metaphor from the human side, so that gametophyte, we can put them in conditions that where it's really mortal if we play around in the lab. So that's what actually the stage we have here in Milwaukee, these gametophytes, right? We can grow them faster, bulk their biomass, keep them in that stage forever, replicate them, and have really large amounts of it. Or we can put them even more stringent conditions and put them on cold with very little light, so that we only need to get in a couple of times a year and change the medium. And it's really an equivalent of a seed bank, right? So we can keep them like that, and we can replicate them, put them in other institutions, a copy of our bank, and in the future understand, together with genetic analysis, understand where we can use this source of material to reinforce or reestablish populations that are probably gone due to some of these problems, like climate change that we've been talking about.
You know, on this program, we've had folks from the UWM School of Freshwater Science on a regular basis. And one of the things we've talked about in the past is fish farming, ways in which we can grow fish inside because of the shortage that's occurring in the oceans. Is there any hope that down the road you could do a hydroponic program around kelp, sort of on a giant scale, to grow it in an empty factory or an empty building, knowing how quickly it grows?
Yes, exactly. That's the challenge, right? So for experimental purposes, people have actually built these big tanks, like big tubes of 10 feet high, where they actually grow the adult plant there. But for experiments, right, for something as a crop, we would have to move this always to the ocean. But what we can have even here in Milwaukee, like we have kind of a very successful program, is this gametophyte stage that, so all the research around the gametophytes, all the growth of the biomass, say if you want to replicate one copy to a very large amount of biomass because it's interesting, we can do all that here and ship it in less than 24 hours to the coast. And there's, you know, so, but yeah, I guess the short answer is no, right? It just grows so much and needs so much nutrients that it needs to be in the ocean.
Because the ocean has all of the raw ingredients, if you will, replicating it would be too tough. Also, another question that occurs to me, is there such a thing as freshwater kelp? And could you engineer something that would be sustainable within the Great Lakes?
No, there's really no freshwater kelp, not really large brown algae in freshwater systems. No.
Okay. Okay. this is why I do this program, because I have a lot of questions. I'm always curious and always amazed at how little I know.
I would be onto it if that would be like only a way. I'm also a diver, so you know I would love to be able to dive in the Great Lakes on something that would look like a kelp forest.
Got it. Well, if there's a way to be done, it'll probably be discovered here at UWM. Felipe, we just have another minute or two left. Where do you see your research going in the next few years? Do you think that we're close to unlocking the key for the long-term massive scale farming of kelp in the oceans in the near future?
I think it's just a start. You know, for our particular results in terms of genetics, we have found like some good associations between some of, you know, the genotypes that we have for these lines and growth. So we can now run a program targeting growth. Okay, we will create one farm where these individuals will grow faster than what you'd expect just by picking a random kelp in the ocean. So that's a good start. Everyone, if you ask industries, that's the most important thing to have, it's yield. So we have more yield out of your aquaculture. So that's where we are right now. So other goals, as you know, temperature tolerance and other things may come in the future with more funding. You know, we're just starting here. And of course, the whole program also depends on all those other categories that involve engineers and right. So, but you know, we're very happy that they've found in 3 years that we found, you know, some strong associations with faster growth. So it's a good start.
Well, we wish you continued success in your research, Felipe, and thanks for joining us on today's program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
Felipe Alberto, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at UWM's College of Letters and Science, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.